Without further ado, let me introduce Sam Munger. Sam has been working with the Center for Wisconsin Strategies with their analysis of banking and investment. We'd like to, I think, take an opportunity here to provide a chance for people to sort of ask some questions after the presentation, but we're going to be having a slideshow as well. And Sam had worked with an outfit called Alice, and I had to ask him what that was stood for. Well, the bottom line is my understanding it's sort of a progressive or left-wing ALEC. So everybody's familiar with that. So Sam, if I could, let me turn the mic over to you, and thank you for coming and talking to us about banking without Wall Street.
Thanks so much for having me. Thanks so much to Deborah for organizing it, and to Dan, and for the kind introduction and for your interest and so on. I'm going to try to talk for about half an hour. I have way too many slides, which some of them I'm going to whip through really quickly, and we can come back to any of that in the Q&A. I'm going to try to leave plenty of time. We have about an hour and a half, something like that. So hopefully that'll leave plenty of time for questions and answers. And I'm happy to talk about Alice and other work we're doing up at the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. But the research that led to the research that on banking and on sort of the financial system was not part of Alice. So I'm mostly going to talk about things that happened on other COWS projects, including one called the Center for State Innovation, which you'll see that logo. But don't worry too much about that. So Banking Without Wall Street is the title of a conference I was at recently, and the content of this presentation is going to loosely track what was talked about at that conference. So you'll see there's going to be there's a lot of slides about public banking and about state banks, and specifically about a research paper that we did on the Bank of North Dakota and so on. I'm going to move through those pretty quickly because I was looking at your website yesterday, and it looked as if you'd had maybe one or two presentations on public banking already. And I was talking to these guys who said that Ellen Brown was out earlier in the year. So if any of you came to that, you will be deeply familiar with the public banking stuff. And I'm not going to go into it too much unless folks have questions. I know Ellen really well, and she's kind of the guru of public banking. And so I don't want to repeat too much of what she said. So I'm going to focus on the other things. A lot of it is about state policy and about different kinds of state and local structures and kind of policy innovations that are ways to use finance and to direct it more locally. It's not what you'd call true revolutionary, subversive financial forms. It's not alternative currencies. It's not a national sort of public bank or getting rid of the Fed. But I'm happy to talk about all of that. To the extent that I know. I'm no Federal Reserve expert. My background's in state policy. But we could get into that stuff. That isn't, though, I realized, because of the sort of, tracking the focus on this conference, that isn't, tracking the content of this conference, that isn't what this is. This will feel maybe a little more incremental than some of the things that we'd all perhaps prefer to see happen. And so I think you guys, I'll just say quickly, my name's Sam Munger. I'm at the Center on Wisconsin Strategies, which is a public policy think tank up at the university, which some of you may have heard of. Professor Joel Rogers is sort of the, leading light and, spiritual leader and founder of the Center on Wisconsin Strategies. The Center on Wisconsin Strategies does a lot of interesting projects. It's a sort of concatenation of a bunch of different grants. My work has mostly been on state policy. And a little bit on local. And so that's what you'll see here. And my background is basically public policy background. I'm not a finance expert by any means. I have a law degree, too. Anyway. If you have any legal questions, I'm not allowed to give you official legal advice. But and so I have a sort of public policy and a state policy perspective on most of this. Okay, so with that, and also I'm going to be wandering around back and forth from the laptop to the podium because I have to flip through these by hand. And like I said, I'm going to try to move through them relatively quickly. But let's talk a little bit about the background for this, right? I know you guys this is a longer series about banking and the Federal Reserve and Wall Street reform, and so I know that you've probably heard people talk in much more detail about some of these topics, but I just want to connect it to the bigger narrative. And I'm obviously, there were lots of things that led up to that financial crisis in 2007, 2008, going back, you know, to the Great Depression and the New Deal and the SEC reforms, certainly going back to the 70s and 80s and Glass-Steagall and the sort of and financial deregulation, all of which, and I'm not going to spend too much time on it, all of which led to what we know happened in 2007, 2008. One of the things that had been happening for a long time, going back even before this, is consolidation and concentration of wealth in a few banks, the classic too-big-to-fail problem. And back in 1990, the four biggest banks, people usually say the big four, the big five, back in 1990, they had about 9% of the assets. By 2008 and 2009, actually, they benefited massively because so many little banks went out of business in the financial crisis. By 2009, they were up to 37. These days, it's more like 39. No signs of it slowing down. So you have a massive concentration of wealth in these big banks. That's led to all kinds of problems, right? It's led to systemic risk. It's led to the too-big-to-fail problem. It's led to us, you know, being on the hook again. And you know, you don't take it from me. Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan, I believe, said there'll be another bubble and crash. He thinks probably in a 10-year window, something like that. I mean, there's nothing really has happened to head that off. Little things like Dodd-Frank and so on, which we can also talk about. This is an example in California. In most states, it's much worse, actually. That's the national figures, and that's in some ways diluted because different states have different banks preeminent. In most states, you see a majority of state deposits, a majority of state assets in a single bank. Here, this is sort of the big five in California, or the big four. They're above two-thirds. That's what, you know, and the blue line is the number of banks. So, you know, it's dropped by half, essentially, or even below. And so you get many, many fewer community banks. And so a lot of what I'm talking about is aimed at bolstering community banks and at figuring out how to make finance more local and to take power, to take money away from these big banks, because ultimately that results in a better and more robust economy, and it results in less systemic risk, right? If you don't have half of your nation's wealth tied up in four acts, you know, if you make them not too big to fail, if you shrink them, then you can let them fail if they you know, make bad bets and get over leveraged. Okay. A lot of these things are also aimed at moving finance locally, because that is good for local businesses, it's good for small businesses, and it's good for the local economy. And that, in turn, is sort of good for the economy as a whole, for reasons that we could talk about, why small local businesses tend to be more beneficial, they keep more assets local, they tend to be less likely to pull up stakes and move to the next jurisdiction for tax reasons, or to the next state, or to the next country, and leave local people holding the bag. This is a complicated graph, the basic point of which is especially when the financial recession hit, credit got really expensive for small businesses. And that's because big banks tend to lend a lot less and have increasingly done less and less lending to small and local businesses. Here's one that, you know, again, these are complicated charts. I'm supposed to be explaining these charts, I was told, since it's on tape, but in some ways, the exact numbers aren't important. The basic point is, large banks have a lot of the money, but small banks do a lot more small business lending. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. But the basic reason is that consumer-level lending to individuals, lending to small businesses, high transaction costs and low dollar amounts, right? I mean, if you're lending to a person or a small business, you know, it's not a multi-billion dollar deal or hundreds of millions of dollars. You're lending in the thousands or tens of thousands, sometimes a couple million. And yet it still has, you know, virtually the same amount of paperwork in some ways, because you still have to, you know, do a credit assessment and assess the risk, and you still have to, you know, actually service the loan and so on. And big banks, they can make more money. They can make more money doing giant deals, and they can make more money, frankly, playing around in all sorts of crazy derivatives markets and currency exchange and investing in Chinese credit cards, which is what one of the banks is putting a lot of its money in, because, you know, higher rates of return, and it's much easier. It's all computer transactions. The other thing that they don't have, increasingly, because they're having fewer and fewer real people in real branches in a lot of communities is the sort of, as they say, soft capital, like that sort of knowledge of which businesses are creditworthy, right? If you have a local banker in a small town, they have a sense of whether you can lend someone money and whether that's a good risk, the classic sort of small town handshake deal. Bank of America, those decisions are being made at a higher level, and frankly, they don't care. They're not, you know, if they look at you on paper and for whatever reason you don't look like a good credit risk, gone. Even though you may have, for whatever reason that someone in town may know, may be a perfectly viable business. So a lot of things, some of the things you'll see here, at least an ancillary point, is to increase small business lending. So I was going to spend, as I said, a lot of time on the publicly owned bank. And that was partly because I spent, you know, a solid year or two of my life doing research and going around the country and talking about publicly owned banks and testifying before different state legislatures and, you know, sort of being involved in different campaigns, and I'm trying to recoup some of that time. But I know you guys have heard a lot about it, so I'm really going to flip through this quickly. I'll just say that up at COWS, up at the Center for State Innovation, we did a pretty... We did a white paper. We did a pretty long report that was an examination of the Bank of North Dakota, which is the one... Well, so it was a general sort of discussion of public banks, and then a pretty close examination of the Bank of North Dakota, which, if you've come to the previous lectures, you'll know is the one existing state-level public bank in this country. It's quite a common model internationally. It's a common model historically. There used to be many, many more. Now there's one, which exists for all kinds of interesting historical and idiosyncratic reasons, having to, you know, in North Dakota and the country. But it's, you know, it's our model. It's an N of one, and we looked at that and tried to model what that would look like in other states and guess about that. And so all of these charts you'll see are from that research report. That's what, it's one of the main pieces of research out there on publicly owned banks and on state banks, and it's what folks like Ellen Brown, who I used to work with a lot at the Public Banking Institute, and Mark Armstrong, if you've talked to him, folks who've worked on public and municipal banks locally here and elsewhere, it's often the research that they're citing. And I'm happy to come back and talk about it more, but I'm going to move through these slides really quickly because I'm thinking that a lot of it is basically elaborations on information that you already know. But you can stop me right now if not. Like, if no one in this room has heard of public banks or if it's totally unfamiliar, raise your hand, stop me, or make me come back to it in the questions and answers. Okay, so as I said, we did an examination of North Dakota, but let me just talk a little bit about the main features of publicly owned banks as opposed to some of the other things we're going to talk about and could talk about. So first, it's a bank. We're going to talk about lots of other things that are revolving loan funds or bond programs or other kinds of forms that aren't actually a bank. A publicly owned bank is, in fact, a bank, which gives it certain kinds of advantages that we could go into and certain kinds of flexibility that we could go into. Its deposits are essentially made up of state money. It's mostly state short-term money, which basically means it's like the state's checking account in a way. Tax receipts go in, it pays the bills, and then there's a lot of money that states have, or there's sort of a float, as it were. You know, so this was true a couple years ago. The Bank of North Dakota has about, imagine, $4 billion in assets. That's for a small state. It needs about $1 billion to pay the bills, roughly. But that gives you, you know, $3 billion thereabouts, kind of, play with, as it were. I mean, to lend. You know, some of that goes into very safe investments, but a lot of it can be used to, you know, lend locally or to invest in things that you think are worthwhile. Not invest, I should say, to lend, because of course it's the people's money. You're not giving it away unless the legislature wants to appropriate. It has public governance, so some form of pretty direct accountability to taxpayers, either via elected officials, essentially, it's a state entity. It's got above it, even though it usually has actual bankers as the staff, it does have people who are actual bankers. They're all basically accountable to a legislative committee and then to the executives, which I think we can all agree would probably be a nice thing for banks. That, in turn, leads to a pretty high level of transparency, much higher than most private banks. And, you know, can get it. There's lots of things that a state or public bank could do. This is what the Bank of North Dakota does. Usually it's essentially it is some version of kind of local lending, and either in participate in partnership with local banks or on its own. Other kinds of support for banks in the state. You know, it's a state entity, so it's very concerned with state policy, and that's basically what it's there to support. If it, in fact, has all of the money for the state, it manages liquidity, which basically means paying the bills and taking the receipts. And then these banks, most banks, like most banks, it makes a profit. Those profits can be plowed back into the bank, which allows it to do more. It, at times, back when before North Dakota was incredibly flush with oil money, and we could also talk about how that factors into the state's success and the bank's success, if we want. At times, back when they had budget deficits, sometimes they would take money out of the bank and plug it into the general fund, basically. As I said, I think that these kinds of banks, among other things, one of the benefits of them, I'll talk about this a little bit at the end, but is that, you know, it's a way of taking money that would otherwise be in too-big-to-fail Wall Street banks, among all these other things, besides the local lending, besides the fact that I think it's sort of an efficient way to run a state's finances, just takes money out of Wall Street, it puts it someplace else, it literally is just putting your eggs in more baskets. It's lessening systemic risk that way.
Can North Dakota State Bank, that is publicly owned, any institution with access to Federal Reserve funds on the same basis as other private banks?
Is that a set up softball question? Yes. There's caveats to that. I mean, this is one place that Ellen Brown and I part company. I think the ability, a little bit, and in a sort of friendly way, but so it's a member of what's called the Federal Home Loan Bank System. Gives its access to a whole set of funds. It hasn't needed them recently. Well, that's not true. It needs them for sort of, banks use the Fed for all kinds of day-to-day operations. That's one of the things, if you guys have been hearing about the Fed, that you've probably heard. There are people who know much more about how that works than I do, but essentially, you know, if you need a little bit of extra cash, sort of on a short-term basis to sort of make your books balance as things come back in, the Fed will provide it to you. The home loan bank system is one way it does that. The federal discount window, the sort of basic Fed that we think of, is another way, and the Bank of North Dakota has access to all of that. It's members of those systems. You have to meet certain requirements for that, which it's met relatively easily. So yes, it's a good way for the state to access some of the same benefits as private banks, and, you know, for the state and vicariously for us, you know, the individuals who presumably benefit a bit more from what a state-owned bank is doing than from what Citibank or JP Morgan are doing. It's not FDIC insured. It is instead underwritten by the sort of full faith and credit of North Dakota, which basically means, you know, North Dakota's butt is on the line. North Dakota tax receipts underwrite it. You guys may know federal FDIC insurance covers up to $250,000 per individual investor. So when you put your money in the bank, you're covered up to $250,000. The idea was, you know, you don't need to. Someone who's got more than that in cash in a bank probably doesn't need the taxpayers to bail them out. They've found other ways to do that, of course. But for the Bank of North Dakota, they have one major investor. Local governments can put money in, private citizens can open accounts, but basically it's all state money. And if they got FDI, so say $4 billion out of the $4 point whatever billion is from North Dakota, it's from a single depositor. They get FDIC insurance, it covers $250,000 of that $4 billion. It doesn't do them a lot of good. And you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get FDIC insured. So it probably didn't make that much sense, I assume. It also grew up historically. It was around before the FDIC, right? It was formed in 1919, so it predates the FDIC, but they decided they never chose to join, and I tend to think that's a reasonable choice. So this is one of the things we found when we did this study is that North Dakota has a particularly healthy banking sector. And again, I'm just going to flip through these quickly, but if we want to come back to it, we can. They tend to have more bank offices than other states, than other sort of comparable states, and then the U.S. average, which is at the bottom. That's one way of just thinking about how available banking services are, bank offices per capita. Like, is there a bank in your town? And as we'll get to with postal banking, lots of people do not have access to bank branches. Surprising number for, you know, folks who live within walking distance of about a dozen bank branches just down the block. These are measures of bank market concentration. It's an index. Never mind, we won't go into it. It's an index called the HHI index. But essentially, North Dakota has a. It's essentially measures how much deposits are concentrated within a state. And North Dakota has much more distribution than most states, meaning sort of healthy, thriving banking sector generally, healthy, thriving local and community banking sector. More loans per capita. I'm just going to flip through these. Fewer loans in default on average. And I want to mention this because I think it's important and because it sets up the rest of the analysis a little bit, but one of the things public banks can do, it's something the Fed does too. It's this sort of common sense sort of thing. When the private markets aren't lending, when credit gets tight, all kinds of public banks, including the Fed, push money out into the economy. This is what the Fed did when the recession hit. This was the sort of TARP, you know, they just were throwing money, and they still are. They're still lending at 0% on the theory that, you know, we need it for the economy. Well, state banks can do that too. And this is a chart from the Banco Estado in Spain, and again, I think it's not important to figure out where the actual bars are, but the basic point is that, you know, mostly the blue ones go up when the red ones go down. And so when other banks were decreasing their lending, the Banco Estado de España was increasing its lending. And the Bank of North Dakota and other public banks do the same thing. So in general, North Dakota banks have a higher loan-to-asset ratio. They had much less steep decline during the recession, meaning that the Bank of North Dakota was sort of ramped up lending when private banks were ramping it down. And that was I mention it because this was how one of the key ways that we imagined how the Bank of North Dakota would look in other states. This is an example from Oregon. Essentially, I'm getting a little bit too into this, I think, a little bit too in the weeds. But let's just say we projected the effects of the Bank of North Dakota of a sort of similar bank in Oregon, and we got, we projected that banks would lend more, and as a result, you would have had less job loss. There's a wide margin of error, but roughly we say 6,000 or 7,000 jobs might not have been lost in Oregon if they'd had an entity like this. And they might have returned money to the state, on the order of millions of dollars, which is, you know, not per year, which is not going to solve your budget deficit, but it's a decent chunk of money. Vermont, you may know, has also, you may have heard, has commissioned a study that we helped on a little bit. They're of states, and we could talk again about which states have looked at this and which states might actually do something. I think Vermont is amongst the most serious at the state level. There's municipal efforts that are a little bit more advanced, probably. But I was at this Banking Without Wall Street conference. I was at several very nice people from Vermont who were talking about this, so I borrowed some of their slides. And again, we could talk about the mechanics. Vermont is looking at building out some existing state entities, their existing economic development apparatus, rather than creating something from whole cloth, which I think makes sense. You know, the Bank of North Dakota has been around since 1919. The state has grown up around it. It's grown up with the state. That's not true in other places. And as a result, I think other states are going to have to think, you know, creatively about what pieces of that you might want to do. What pieces of it make sense, how to integrate it with an existing state. I think it's unrealistic to think you'll just slap down a particular model from say, North Dakota in this case, especially when it's such a big entity and sort of has so many moving parts, has all of the state's money. So just in thinking about how you pitch it, I think it has to be tailored to a particular state. So in Vermont, they're thinking about using the existing Economic Development Agency, VEDA. This is a comparison of Vermont and North Dakota. You may have seen this chart before, maybe not, but it's both striking, and I think, again, without going into the numbers, the basic point is that Vermont and North Dakota are very similar sized states in many ways, relatively similar population, relatively similar amount of money in the state, general budget. Vermont has way fewer banks. It has way much more of its money is held in banks out of state, even though it has more, it's sort of doing more lending, way less of it is going to economic development, way less of it is going to support economic activity within the state. And back when this was done, which was 2010, I think, or 2009 and 2010, Vermont had about twice the unemployment of North Dakota. Again, multiple reasons for that, but we think that the state bank is part of it. This was the gist of their study. They thought that a public bank of the sort that they're talking about could create about 2,500 new jobs, about $192 million in GSP, basically in economic activity, and within the state, and then $342 million in state output. They used a more sophisticated and sort of more extensive measure of that than we did, which I think was smart. Okay, that was public banks. I know I ended up talking about that for a bit. Let's talk about some other kinds of alternative financial institutions. One that's gotten a lot of attention is something that's called green banks. Not actually a bank. It is can be configured in a variety of ways, but essentially it's collection of loan funds, of bonding, of bonding ability, of other sorts of financial instruments that are intended to spur energy efficiency, spur environmentally beneficial projects within a state, spur energy projects within a state, both for environmental purposes and to create jobs. And I think it's not revolutionary, I think it's a really useful instrument. One of the first ones was started in Kentucky in 2009. It was very modest. It basically took some of the money that came out of the American Recovery and the Recovery Act and put it towards doing energy efficiency in public buildings, which, again, is probably a thing that you guys have heard of. But, one of the great things, there are people with cows who can talk for hours about this, including Joel Rogers. But one, the basic point about things like, putting insulation in your roof, about basic kinds of retrofits of buildings, is that they save money. They can pay with that energy savings, you can both pay back a loan and still see money come off your bill. Essentially, they can be financially sustainable. And if that's the case, there's no reason that, say, public entities can't invest in them. There's no reason that they shouldn't. They can both, it's not sort of a subsidy in some sense. It can be a revolving loan program. You can have a pool of money that goes to do these great energy efficiency programs and gets paid back. And so then you can lend it out to someone else. That's the basic idea behind green banks and behind this green bank. Connecticut has a much more extensive one. This is a description of it. I realize I have way too much information on these slides, but at any rate, it's a little more complicated. It has more sources of revenue. A tenth of a cent per kilowatt charge on electric bills goes into it, and also there's something called REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is sort of just in New England, they have a kind of cap and trade system, and revenues from that also feed into it. This is a little bit more. I'm going to skip right through it. We can talk about what sorts of projects they do. Another kind of model is what's called an infrastructure bank. Same idea, but basically going to build infrastructure, which both, we're hoping to move away from the interstate highway system. We're hoping to promote kinds of sustainable transit. Nonetheless, the interstate highway system, bridges, tunnels, they're not going away anytime soon. We have a huge need for infrastructure projects. This is basically a way for states to take some public money to use it creatively to fund needed infrastructure projects, including a whole range of things, sewers, green infrastructure, school upgrades, and so on, and to create jobs by doing that, and then to do it in a way that sort of renews itself. And it involves an appropriation, a significant appropriation from the state. So there's some public money, but it is a one-time appropriation. It doesn't have to get plugged in every year because it renews. And then different kinds of creative bonding and other sorts of interactions with the private financial market. So again, we're not talking about undermining Wall Street. We're talking about states working with Wall Street in creative ways that don't result in them losing their shirt quite as much as they do currently. Again, I think I'm going to skip through a lot of this. Another model that I think is quite interesting and that folks may have heard a little bit about are called land banks. It's essentially a way to address, well, I was going to say the foreclosure crisis, but sort of sets of problems that were particularly noted during the foreclosure crisis, but exist at other times as well. It's an entity that focuses on the conversion of vacant, abandoned, tax delinquent, underwater properties into productive use in one way or another, and they do that by hanging on to them, redeveloping them themselves, or putting together multiple abandoned properties into a larger plot that they can then sell off. Again, it sometimes requires a little bit of investment from. This mostly happens at the local level. It sometimes requires a little bit of investment from the local government, but really should be sort of self-sustaining. It shouldn't cost taxpayers a huge amount because they're selling off property regularly, and they often take a percentage of future property tax revenues from those properties once they go back into productive use. Whoops. Oof. I know this had all these transitions. This is one of the dynamics that we could talk about with land banks. Basically, these are all goals and beneficial effects of a land bank. You can create affordable housing. You eliminate blight, obviously, because you're buying up underwater and abandoned properties. You can incent home ownership. You can bring revenues in. You can create green spaces if you want to turn things into parks. And you can enforce housing codes by forcing subcode properties to come up to code. Some of those things you have to kind of trade off against each other. So the most obvious is you can put more money into creating affordable housing, or you can try to get more money in revenue. To some extent, you're trading off those two because affordable housing is seldom the most profitable use. Again, I'm sorry to be skipping through these so quickly. I know it's a little bit of a blizzard of information. I'm happy to come back to any of this in Q&A if folks want. This Michigan has been sort of ground zero for innovation in land banks for reasons that are, I think, are self-evident if you think about it. Detroit, Michigan's had a huge problem with, it's had a exodus, a large loss of population. It obviously had got really walloped during the economic recession. So it just had a huge number of underwater properties and vacant properties, and so they had to be creative. And indeed, ground zero in Michigan was Genesee County, which is Flint, Michigan. So if you ever, if you saw Roger and Me, it's gotten worse since then, right? So if you picture the people skinning rabbits and living in these kind of dilapidated buildings, Flint has an incredibly active land bank. Right now, it's been responsible for more than 10,000 properties that have been foreclosed in Flint. It's demolished homes. It's rehabilitated hundreds of homes. It's tried to redevelop historic buildings. And, this is in a town with not a huge number of public assets, so it can be done, even in places that don't have a ton of money. Another thing I want to talk about quickly is moving your money. You guys may remember the Move Your Money movement directed at consumers. Basically, take your money out of the big 4 or 5 too big to fail banks, put it into local banks and credit unions. I think that is a great idea. We should all do that to the extent we can. And so should, but we, again, as individual and not, I'll speak for myself, as people of relatively modest means, we're not a huge percentage of the market. So one thing that we've thought a little bit about is how to expand the Move Your Money movement and how to move more money, essentially, how to expand that. By the way, I put this back up because one of the reasons, there's multiple reasons to take money out of Wall Street banks, and a lot of them, I think, are intuitive. You want them to have less influence, less power, less money to lobby with, and so on. You want to lessen the systemic risk, as they say, which basically means make them not too big to fail anymore by taking money away. You also, by moving money into local banks, you essentially are giving more money to local businesses. Bank local, I think, again, there's lots of research and argument underneath this, but banking local, like buying local and eating local, essentially is beneficial to local economy and to cities. Just to go back a half step, what we thought about is how to move public money, that is to say, not just your individual bank account, but the state's bank account and the city's bank account into local banks. It's not as easy as you might think, and we could get into why, but there are ways to do it. One way that we worked on with the Massachusetts Treasurer is essentially to, to take state money that would otherwise be in sort of big depository institutions and, move them into small and community banks with the understanding that they're going to do worthwhile things, meaning essentially they're going to do small business lending in their community. And they did that initially with $100 million, now $200 million that the treasurer had discretion over in Massachusetts. That's not true in every state, but in a lot of states the treasurer would have the ability to do that. These were our estimates of, again, the specific numbers aren't that important, but this is amounts of increased lending. Basically, I think we came to the conclusion that for every $10 million you moved from a too-big-to-fail money center bank into a smaller bank, you'd create 5 to 8 jobs, something like that, in the state, which, doesn't sound like a giant return, but when you consider that that it's essentially a good policy, even irrespective of the fact that it tends to incentivize job creation or spur job creation in a state, I think seems pretty worthwhile. In general, we think that cities and counties should be thinking about moving their money out of money center banks and out of Wall Street and into community banks in a whole variety of ways. These are some options that folks have thought about. For each one, there are opportunities, there are challenges, which I think I won't get into too much here, but there are, you can think about moving essentially city and state checking accounts into community banks, you can think about moving their savings accounts, and you can think about moving their sort of long-term investments. And like I said, for each one, I think sort of in increasing order, it's increasing amounts of money, increasing opportunities, and increasing difficulty to some extent in moving that public money. These are a bunch of examples of policies that have actually passed in various places. One of the ways that you see this actually be passed into law, because it's a little tricky both politically and on a policy level, is what are called Lend Local initiatives or responsible banking initiatives, which basically involve cities, counties, or states either sort of giving local institutions a little boost, like giving them extra points, essentially, when they're applying to receive public money, or saying that 10% of our city deposits are going to go into local banks and credit unions. There's a sort of variety of ways you can do this, and some really big cities have done this, including Los Angeles, including Portland, setting aside a particular dollar amount, like $10 million that will be distributed among local banks and credit unions. And I think this is the kind of thing that, Madison could think about immediately, more or less. The level of logistics are not that great. Okay, one last model that I wanted to talk about, at least in the, in these banking worlds that I travel in and at this conference, there was a lot of excitement around it. I don't know if it's something that you folks have heard about, but, essentially the concept is having the U.S. Postal Service, through post offices, offer some kinds of banking services. The essential problem that we're trying to address here is the fact that a huge number of people, especially obviously those sort of poor and working class, are unbanked or underbanked. So on the left you can see there's, by some estimates, 30, maybe 40% of the population that don't take advantage of the traditional banking system at all for a whole variety of reasons. One of the reasons is lack of access to a bank. This is framed in terms of where post offices are, but I still think it's a really striking stat, which is that almost 40% of post offices are in zip codes with no banks at all. Sorry, that's 40%. There's no banks in, not one bank branch. Again, I mean, I don't know. It's a striking stat to me. When you live within a few blocks of, however many bank branches there are down on Capitol Square, I mean, a half dozen or something, it's amazing to think that there are people who live in a whole zip code that have no bank, 40% of the country. That tends to be basically inner city neighborhoods and rural zip codes. There's another 20% of folks who have only one bank branch. So that's, 60% of the population that has very little access to banks. And, we tend to think, oh, well, so many things can be done online. But, of course, often these are people who don't have great access to the internet either. It's not, these are people who have very, very limited access to banks. An institution that tends to be in pretty much every zip code for good reasons and bad is your local post office. I mean, it literally just has the infrastructure. It's in the places where people are that need banking. On the left, I sort of jot, these are sort of the main argument that folks make who think that the post office should be in this business. So it's present in the places where people need banking. Essentially, the payday lending industry is sort of, is one of the truly, I think, bad actors in the American economy. And there's a huge amount of space between what the payday lenders charge and what you might need to charge in order just to be sort of sustainable. This is sort of there. So I should go back a half step. The reason that this is getting a lot of attention recently is that in January of this year, this is an idea that's been kicking around in some form or another for a long time. The post office actually used to offer certain kinds of financial services, and it's a relatively common practice internationally. In January, the Office of the Inspector General of the U.S. Postal Service issued this big white paper that basically examining the possibilities, so sort of officially saying that the U.S. Postal Service was considering doing this. When that was released, needless to say, certain people were, so I thought I had this jotted down, but so Elizabeth Warren, for instance, immediately, and the CFPB immediately endorsed it, said this was a great idea. The private banking industry immediately started screaming bloody murder on the same thing that you hear every time any sort of innovative financial proposal is brought up. Oh, it'll ruin the American economy. These guys don't know what they're doing. They're not bankers. They're going to lose taxpayer money. They're going to, they're going to bankrupt the country. They're not competent. I think there are legitimate concerns, which I'll touch on briefly, but essentially they don't want competition, nor do the payday lenders. That's part of the reason that we're talking about it now. From that white paper that the Inspector General wrote, the post office estimated it could charge, about a tenth of what payday lenders do, effectively, and still break even. So you have a chance to save people a lot of money. And there's some, just sort of kind of appalling stats about how much these folks who are outside the banking system end up, just losing, just forking over to extractive lenders. So, if you're the average household that is underserved by banking, spends $2,500 a year, roughly, on interest and fees to payday lenders and other kinds of what they call alternative financial services, which is about 10% of their income, because you're talking about people who are relatively poor, and that's a huge amount. And as you see here, payday loans, the paper interest rate looks quite low, but because there are this constant cycle of fees being due and then interest being compiled and penalties being assessed, you end up with an effective APR of around 400%. So think about that next time you look at your credit card and are sort of whatever, aghast at paying 17% or something for of an effective APR. That's only if you don't pay off your loans at the end of your, sort of pay off your credit card at the end of each month. They're paying, this is 400% roughly. We talked about how post offices are in loan deserts. Looks like that's a repeat. Just as an aside, a lot of what this report was talking about, and a lot of what people were talking about, at least initially, would be these very kind of basic and non-traditional bank services. So it's not traditional savings accounts and so on. It would be these things like prepaid credit or debit cards, meaning when your salary is deposited, it goes onto this card, and you can use that card with no fee, you know, unlike a, say, a lot of the cards that are offered now, unlike an EBT card, unlike a credit card, no fee of any kind to pay off debts. So it would just be an easy way for people in who are underbanked or unbanked to manage financial transactions. There's a whole, that's what they call, anyway, open loop reloadable prepaid cards, a whole other range of things, just none of which you'll note really intrude on what, you know, basic, on basic consumer banking. So, you know, it shouldn't incite quite so much opposition from private banks. Let's see. I think these are my extra slides. Yes, and we can. This is the signal to me that it's the end of the presentation. I'm happy to talk about Alice if necessary. That's the or if you guys are interested. I do want to touch on. You know, sorry to wind up with a whimper rather than a bang. I did want to touch on a couple of the potential problems with postal service banking, because it sounds like such a sort of panacea and a kind of a fantastic idea. You wonder why people aren't doing it already, especially considering it's been around that the U.S. postal system historically did some of this, and that it's true internationally, and that even now, I should say, the postal system does a certain amount of financial transactions. Let me see if I jot it down. But you know, the postal system already has the capacity to sort of fill money orders and to transfer money, so it already has some of the infrastructure in place, sort of has, you know, some of the basic, you know, kind of electronics and so on necessary to transfer money from place to place, some of what you need to set up a banking system. I think that, particularly with regard to the lending, the concern is, so for instance, post offices would be able to charge far, far less than, say, payday lenders, but you'd still be talking about interest rates like 40 or 50%. That's a pretty high interest rate. I mean, that could seem, you know, extractive, usurious or something. And there's a question about whether we'd be comfortable with the federal government, with the public entity, charging folks 50%. The reason that you wouldn't end up charging that much, the reason that these folks have trouble getting banking is, you know, to some extent, they are not great credit risks. They have a not great credit history. They have, you know, their income is relatively low. They may have debts and so on. So, you know, you have a relatively high chance of default. Some of these people, a relatively high percentage of folks who you, in this category, are not going to pay back money, are not going to be able to. And so you have to charge a higher interest rate to make up for that, or you have to resign yourself to losing money, which, you know, I think I, for one, would be comfortable with, you know, sort of providing banking services and having to appropriate a certain amount of federal money to cover losses, but many people wouldn't. The other problem with this basic dynamic with default is if someone defaults on a loan or can't pay back or overdrafts, what do you do as the U.S. postal system? You know, you have a consumer, they owe you money, they have some assets, they have maybe a house, maybe a car. A traditional bank goes after those things. Again, do you want the federal government in the position of sort of impounding people's cars or effectively, or going after their house, or more likely, garnishing their tax refunds or their Social Security benefits or other kinds of federal benefits that they're receiving? You know, saying, well, you know, you can get most of your Social Security check, but we're just going to take off 10% to pay ourselves back. You can see why people might be uncomfortable with that setup too, or in even the sort of potential for it. I think that the postal banking is an idea with a lot of potential. It's an idea that a lot of folks are enthusiastic about. There's sort of obvious political hurdles, but it's a definite possibility.